Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Of the many questions surrounding the Germanwings crash, there is also this. When something like this happens, what do you do if you're not the airline it happened to? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 26th of March. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. German Chancellor Angela Merkel might have said it best today. Speaking about the latest news of the plane crash in France, Merkel called it a new and, quote, simply incomprehensible dimension, end of quote. There is more to come, obviously, in the investigation and whatever is going to happen next. But there is also, industry-wide, a phenomenon going on right now. It's no secret that when it comes to competing for passengers, the airline industry is as brutal as it gets. At the same time, though, when something horrible happens to one of them, like Germanwings, it affects all the airlines to one degree or another. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports there is a history of airlines banding together during tragedy, both out of respect, but also in self-preservation.
When a plane crashes, it doesn't matter whose plane it is, the entire industry is affected. And the entire industry responds, first by calming people's fears. Madhu Unnikrishnan covers the airline industry for Aviation Week.
So, for example, you know, if a passenger has a question about the type of aircraft being used on his or her flight, the call center employees usually are briefed on how to answer those questions.
Business as usual is also put on hold.
First, they will suspend events, promotional marketing events, for example.
Tragedies bring out cooperation in other areas, says Richard Aboulafia, an airline analyst with the Teal Group.
Yeah, I think the most important thing they think about is how to engage with regulatory officials in a positive way.
Several carriers have already announced rules changes requiring two pilots to remain in the cockpit at all times, and it's likely changes won't end there.
I'd be surprised if there weren't some kind of changes that resulted from this, because you've got a series of incidents, a set of data points, if you will, that really point to the impact of human malice in the cockpit, whether it's the Malaysia flight, the Egypt Air crash from a few years ago.
Eventually, airlines will return to what they do best, compete for business, but Aboulafia says one thing you will never see them compete on is safety. For one, most carriers fly the same planes, and they have zero interest in raising concerns about a competitor's pilots or equipment. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
All right, moving on. Now, the phrase payday lending brings with it a certain taint, more than a whiff of outrageous interest rates in what's called a debt trap, high interest loans that keep rolling over and rolling over. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, is out with some new rules today to fix that as much as it can. It wants lenders to consider a borrower's ability to repay the loan, for instance, and also perhaps limit the number of loans that borrowers can take out. But even without those controls, borrowers keep on going back. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at payday loan demand.
A typical payday borrower might make $30,000 a year, says the Pew Charitable Trusts. She may get a loan for a couple $100 for things like rent or to pay an electric bill. Greg McBride is with Bankrate.com.
What would you do? You can pay $50 to borrow $300 and keep your lights on, or get the electricity shut off.
And pay late fees and reconnection fines to get the power turned back on.
You can see why there's a demand for it and why people choose to go this route.
McBride says borrowers simply might not have a choice. Traditional banks generally don't make small loans, and borrowers may not qualify if they did. Or borrowers might decide these loans are the best of limited options. Dennis Schall is the CEO of the Community Financial Services Association of America. It's a trade group that represents short-term lenders.
They may be able to use their credit card. They may have very small savings. They may have the ability to pay a bill late, to bounce a check. They can borrow from a relative. But all those things have consequences.
Schall agrees with the CFPB that lenders should evaluate people's ability to repay loans. He says these products aren't meant for people who are habitually short on cash. The problem is, that's often exactly how they're used.
What we need are viable options and alternatives.
Wade Henderson is the president of the Leadership Conference for Civil and Human Rights.
There are proposals, for example, to allow the U.S. Postal Service to offer a limited product in this area with far lower interest rates.
Henderson says the terms people agree to show how desperate they are for the money. The trick is to find a way to meet that need that doesn't leave them worse off than when they started. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
A funny thing happened in the House of Representatives today. There was broad bipartisan support and a vote along the same lines for a more permanent solution to the perennial question of how much Medicare reimburses doctors, what has been called the Doc Fix legislation. The deal does have the president's support and still needs, of course, to pass the Senate. But let's play it out here for just a second, because what do you suppose happens to those doctors when they get out from under a threat, that is reduced Medicare payments, that has been dogging them since 1997? Well, it turns out business might get a little bit tougher, as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from our help desk at WHYY.
Here's how American Medical Association President-elect Dr. Stephen Stack ended our interview today.
Very good.
You mind if I leave you one more quote?
No, go for it.
So I don't want to pass the opportunity to thank Speaker Boehner and Leader Pelosi.
Stack knows there's almost no chance that kind of quote would ever make it to air, but he wanted to say it anyway. Take it as a sign of the relief he's cautiously feeling on behalf of the 94% of doctors who've worried about Congress cutting their pay.
Having stability and predictability in physician payment is essential for quality of care and patient safety.
Under the bill, docs would see a 0.5% bump in each of the next 4 years, well below the cost of inflation, the price they pay for predictability. There's another price doctors may pay, though, warns the Urban Institute's Bob Berenson, namely more reporting requirements. Berenson says some lack the IT infrastructure to pull it off.
Small practices will find this a too much of a reporting burden and may just decide to throw in the towel.
Another key provision would pay doctors more for high-quality care rather than the volume of care. Everybody loves that, says Harvard's Dr. Ashish Jha. The trouble is it's very hard to measure quality.
We're going to focus on paying doctors for a lot of things, some of which probably represent real quality, and some of which clearly represent checking the box.
Jha says if Washington is serious about paying based on quality, the government must invest in it. Absent that, doctors may have more financial stability thanks to this deal, but less certainty about how to best serve their patients. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, really lousy at the open, just a hair lousy at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Among the industries exceptionally hard hit by the Great Recession is one that odds are you have not thought of yet. Plant nurseries. The housing bust, competition from big box stores, and some really lousy winters combined to do the trick. But it is not the end of the road for America's greenest industry, as Marketplace's Bree Benishore reports.
It feels like 80 degrees in these giant greenhouses, 20 minutes outside of Dayton, Ohio. There are thousands of plants growing in here, and there's also a strategy growing.
The one we're standing in front of, Savory, is actually a black raspberry. It's the first black raspberry ever to have two crops. So it's a fall bearing and a spring bearer.
Felix Cooper is vice president of Gardens Alive. They own plant nurseries and seed companies, and they sell environmentally friendly garden products.
Right across there, we have one of our new grapes. It's a grape that has this continuously fruiting trait. It's the coolest thing we've seen in a long time.
I didn't even know there was such a thing as a black raspberry, let alone a double fruiting one. But it's not just cool, it's important to the business. Niles Kinnerk runs Gardens Alive.
There's no question in my mind, the future for any business in our industry has to rely on providing to particular niche markets that the big boxes, you know, don't view as big enough to justify their interest.
Big box stores. They are the biggest source of competition for plant nurseries, and between them and the recession, the plant nursery business has gotten nailed. Nationwide, it's lost a third of its growers. So to survive, many nurseries have gone online and are offering what the big box stores aren't: variety and weirdness.
Okay, there's an Amorphophallus titanum.
Tony Avent runs Plant Delights Nursery in North Carolina, where half of the nursery industry was wiped out during and after the recession. And he has taken the whole variety and weirdness strategy to the next level.
It's a plant that has a flower that's 7 to 9 foot tall. It has a smell that resembles, say, running over a pack of animals out in the road, and the smell that would occur several weeks later.
Huh. Roadkill in the garden. Who would buy that?
Yeah, I've heard of it. Yes, I have. Yeah.
Greg Matusky is a big-time gardener just out of Philadelphia, and no, he actually wouldn't buy the 9-foot-tall dead carcass plant.
But every year I try something which I consider exotic, something different. So I've grown tobacco, for instance. I've grown cotton. I've grown peanuts. This year I'm going to grow capers.
And he didn't get them from a big box store.
If you can find four or five different variety of tomatoes at Home Depot, you're doing pretty well. The selection is much greater when you go online.
Tony Avent at Plant Delights Nursery says this is because the decline of the nursery industry and the rise of the garden department has had a fundamental impact on the plants themselves.
Everything has shifted to plants that have a fast production time, plants which are what's called a seven-racker. Breed your plant short enough so that they can fit on a seven-racker truck. It doesn't really matter anymore to a lot of plant breeders how the plant's going to perform in the garden.
There are a few other things going in the nursery's favor. One is the simple fact that so many of them have gone out of business, which means there's less competition for the ones still around. There are now shortages of some plants that take a while to grow, like landscape trees. Most growers didn't plant many of them 5 years ago when things were bad, so there aren't enough ready now. And that's great for businesses in that niche.
There are actually people who go out and scout landscapes. They will actually go out to properties and proposition the owners to say, we will pay you $50,000 for this tree if you allow us to come in and dig it and move it to a property because of the shortage in the industry.
But the main thing the plant nurseries are banking on is gardeners like Greg Matusky, with a discerning green thumb and a penchant for growing his own food.
Tomatoes are one thing that really blow your brains out when you taste them and you realize what a real tomato tastes like. Cucumbers I find to be the same thing. Eggplant, less bitter than you'll ever taste from the supermarket.
So from new varieties to online merchandising, nurseries are doing everything they can to stick around, supplying gardeners who want fresh pea plants and those who want plants that smell like pea. If the strategy is right, it may, after a six-year winter, finally be spring for the plant nursery industry. In Dayton, Ohio, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Not that we necessarily need it, but today Twitter made it easier for us to live stream our lives. Their new broadcasting app, Periscope, it's called, went live today, a couple of months after Twitter bought it for $100 million. That follows what may prove to be the flash-in-the-pan success of Meerkat, which does basically the same thing, but sadly for them, isn't owned by Twitter, which may be a possibly insurmountable obstacle. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
I got to tell you, man, as a radio guy, I'm a little ashamed to say this, but I really like these new live streaming apps, the whole Meerkat Periscope things. Is it a sign?
Yeah, you've been Meerkatting.
I have been Meerkatting. So it's a sign of things to come, right?
I think so. I mean, we're in the early days here. I can't Periscope you periscoping me right now. I don't know which one of us is down Periscope. But I think that something that's interesting about this, right, Kai, is that live streaming is not a new idea.
Right.
This has now gone mobile. And you've heard of Ustream. Mm-hmm. There's another one called YouNow. And people can actually tip each other on this, like give each other money for people's live streams. Yes. And there's a hashtag on YouNow called Sleeping Squad, where you can actually pay over 50 different people to watch them sleep, which is...
Oh, man. Seriously?
It's curious and creepy.
Come on, man. Really?
This is the weird Wild West days of live streaming on your mobile phone and being able to interact with people, which is cool.
Yes. However,
where's the money, right?
Interestingly, that was my next question, because somehow, some way, Twitter's going to have to monetize Periscope. If Meerkat sticks around, it's going to have to be monetized, let alone YouNow and tipping other people to sleep.
Yes. And if you know about Twitch, right, Kai?
Yeah, that's the gamer thing, which is huge. I mean, that must be said, right?
Right. Twitch lets people stream themselves playing video games,
right,
which is something that I would never imagine that people would actually really, really like doing. But here's a number, 20 million. That's the number of viewers who watched a live stream of a video game in the first week it was released on Twitch last year. It's a really big deal. Twitch was bought by Amazon last year, you remember, for a little bit over $1 billion.
$1 billion, yeah.
There are reports this week that YouTube is preparing its own video game streaming service. The thing that's tricky about this is, unlike live television or live broadcast radio, as we both know, there aren't as many protections to chaos.
So, I mean, well, enlighten me. What can happen?
Have you heard of swatting, Kai?
I have. Yes, I have. It's that thing where people call the police and send SWAT teams and 911 teams to some unsuspecting people, right?
Yes. And for a hacker, they want to be able to play this prank on someone and have, in some cases, 55,000 people watching this guy, you know, get thrown on the ground by police. And this is a big problem because we want to make money. We have to have some control over advertising.
Well, and you have to have control over what happens so that advertisers are attracted to it, right?
Exactly.
So tell me then what, you know, Twitter is going to do with Periscope and what the Twitch folks are doing. I mean, they must be thinking of this.
They are. The last time I was in San Francisco, I talked with the CEO of Twitch. His name is Emmett Shear, and I asked him about this.
The key thing for us is, cooperating with law enforcement. And then secondly, you know, honestly, not talk about it publicly too much because I think that there's a negative impact from giving too much attention to people who are honestly seeking attention by doing this.
Fair point, but come on, man, that's not a strategy.
I know, but we're in this interesting moment, Kai, where interest in live streaming is growing like crazy. Yep. There's money to be made, but people who are in this part of the tech industry don't really want to talk about swatting this growing problem because they don't want to encourage it. But at the same time, you need some dialogue if you're going to put protections against it.
And it's all fun and games until somebody gets hurt.
Exactly.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
You know, my grandfather in many ways was like most people's grandparents. He'd slip me a $10 bill every now and again.
When your biggest financial lesson comes from family, our latest collaboration with the New York Times, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 40 points today, about 0.2%, closed at 17,678. The NASDAQ off 13 points, about 0.25%, 4,863. The S&P 500 down 4 points, almost 0.25% there. Ended the day at 2,056. Traders were down on consumer loan companies in light of the news we told you about, the federal government's plan to bring new rules to payday lenders. Enova International off almost 18%. World Acceptance Corp, which is actually the name, nearly 15% to the offside. Easy Corp, close to 6% down. Winnebago Industries is sometimes mentioned as a bellwether. Well, today the company sure had its bell run shares. Downshifted 14%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Daybook, here's a look at the events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues its final estimate for 2014's fourth quarter gross domestic product. The 38th annual American Crossword Puzzle Tournament gets underway in Stamford, Connecticut. And cast members from Mad Men are at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History to donate costumes and other objects from the show that will become part of a new exhibit on business. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. What if you could combine sports, instant gratification, maybe make a little money while you're at it, and never have to leave the comfort of your own home? Generally speaking, you can't bet online in this country. What you can do, though, is pick your favorite players, set up a fantasy team where your win-loss record is based on how those players do, not their teams, and then make some money that way. 41 million people play fantasy sports in the U.S. and Canada. Call it a different kind of national pastime, I guess. Nigel Eccles is the CEO of the daily fantasy sports company FanDuel. Nigel, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
For the uninitiated, tell me exactly what it is that FanDuel does.
FanDuel's a daily fantasy sports site and app where you can play and win in fantasy sports leagues that last just one day.
Play and win is a polite way to say bet, yes?
No, it's like fantasy sports. It's a game of skill. So you compete with other people in drafting teams. But yes, there is real money to be won.
How much real money?
So last year we paid out over $500 million in prizes, about $550 million in prizes.
So who are your users? I mean, are they all nickel and diming it, or are there big money players? Or I mean, who's the crowd?
There's a huge range. So in the fourth quarter last year, we had over 1 million paying users. Everyone from somebody who comes in to play maybe once or twice during the football season, or games start at $1, up to people that are just avid fans that play maybe hundreds of leagues every day. We've got the huge range. And the game is great like that because some people love sports, they love basketball, but they're never going to be committed enough to play a season-long fantasy basketball league. And with this, you're just committing to one evening.
Are you intrinsically a fantasy sports fan, or is it the business side of it that does it for you?
So when I started, I wasn't. It was the business side that really got us going. But since then, I've become a pretty big fan.
Yeah, so tell us the origin story, because it's pretty interesting. I mean, you were on a plane flipping through the Anti-Gambling Act or whatever it is.
So there was kind of two parts to it. You know, one part was we originally had an online prediction game called HubDub. This is around 2009, and that wasn't working. So we really had to come up with something else. One of the things I looked at was the Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act 2006, which basically specified fantasy sports. And we looked at it and said, you know, there's nothing that says that fantasy sports has to last 6 months. It could last one day. When we started, everybody said the best day of the year was the draft and kind of the worst day, you know, probably like week four, week five, whenever their team, they realized that they were never going to win. And so we thought, how do we make every day the best day? And how do we avoid that problem of drafting lousy players?
And you guys take a slice of the daily entry fee or the season entry fee or whatever it is, and that's your profit margin?
Yes. So we typically pay out about 90% of the entry fees and prizes, and so the remaining 10% is a commission to us.
I was surprised to read, I will confess that I was surprised to read, that the NBA is actually partnering with you. I mean, they want to be in on this action.
Yes. The NBA is a partner. They're also an investor. So it actually was very straightforward when we met with the NBA. We showed them what fantasy basketball was doing for consumption of basketball. We showed that when somebody became a fantasy basketball player, they went from watching 4 games a week to watching 7 games a week.
Huh.
And when you realize that we have 500,000 fantasy basketball players, they were suddenly saying, wow, this is actually driving consumption.
Hmm. Talk to me for a second about college basketball and March Madness. Do you guys play in that at all?
So we do, yeah, we do college sports, college football, college basketball. It's not as big as the professional sports. The challenge is that people know their colleges and they know the colleges support. Probably most of them don't know the players as well as they do the professional sports. And particularly with basketball, you get one and done.
It's hard
to get time to know that player. And so that's where fantasy is more challenging for the college sports.
Nigel Eccles, he's the founder and CEO of a company called FanDuel. Nigel, thanks very much.
No problem. Thank you.
We've got a regular thing we do a couple of times a year with the New York Times, a collaboration focusing on personal finance. For this go-round, personal lessons about money. And first up is a story from New York Times Wealth Matters columnist Paul Sullivan.
My grandfather was the first wealthy person I ever knew in my life. But by wealthy, I mean somebody who is financially secure, not somebody who earned a lot of money. For his entire life, he was a postman. And he loved being a postman. That was a job he wanted after coming out of World War II. Everything he wanted in life, he was able to do. My parents weren't the best financial planners. You know, people, if they're lucky enough, they can rely on their parents for a little bit of money. I wasn't able to do that. You know, my grandfather in many ways was like most people's grandparents. He'd slip me a $10 bill every now and again. He'd give me a $20 bill here and there. I always sort of knew in the back of my mind that, you know, if my planning with my money went awry, I had a backstop. I had a backstop in my grandfather, and if I needed a couple $100, he could probably help me out. My grandfather had Alzheimer's, and he started to get really sick. And his mind, which is always his greatest asset, it started to slip. And I remember, it turned out to be 2 weeks before he died. I went up to visit him in a nursing home, and it was sort of in that last moment of our visit, and he said, everything will be okay. 2 weeks later, he passed away. Right after he passed away, I thought, who am I going to call? You know, I'm alone. Then I realized, I don't have a backstop. It was jarring at first, but it was also also very sobering, because I thought, okay, you know, he's taught me these financial lessons, and now it's up to me. I mean, that's where I realized that my grandfather hadn't just been a backstop. He'd been a great teacher.
Paul Sullivan is a columnist at the New York Times. He's also the author of The Thin Green Line. We've got more essays from our collaboration with the New York Times, including one from me. It's in the special Your Money section of the actual newspaper today, or you can read them at our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, you could call it the Beyond the Grave edition. Dean Smith, the legendary basketball coach for the University of North Carolina Tar Heels, died early last month. It turns out, though, that in his will, Smith specified that every player who earned a varsity letter while he was there was to get a check for $200, along with a note encouraging them to take a dinner out, compliments of Coach Dean Smith, which I think is kind of nice.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
All done. Got to go. The Dow off 40 points today, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ dropped 13. That's 0.25%. The S&P 500 off 4 points, almost 0.25% there. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you again tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.